Benny Binion was many things: a cowboy, gangster, casino mogul, founder of the wildly successful World Series of Poker. But Binion is also most remembered for his crucial role in shaping early Las Vegas. During the era when Las Vegas was run by the mob, Binion knew how to treat a guest. But Benny Binion was also a brutal man. He had local politicians in his corner. He bribed the cops and used violence when necessary. Doug Swanson documents the colorful and violent life of Benny Binion in Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion. He is an investigative journalist with the Dallas Morning News, and he joins us now. Doug Swanson, welcome to KNPR.
Thank you very much.
Benny Binion came from a Texas backwater town. He built his first gambling empire in Dallas during the Depression. What did that business look like, and how successful was he in Dallas?
Well, he started small. Actually, he started as a bootlegger in Dallas during Prohibition, and then he moved on to what was called a policy game, which was really a numbers operation. And that was a big operation, but it was, high margin, but low capital operation. He wanted to get into the dice business, and finally he did. In 1936, he opened up his first big dice room at a downtown Dallas hotel.
So what is it about gambling and trouble that drew Benny Binion at such an early age? Was it the lure of money, or was there just something else in his character?
Well, it was where he went to school, really. And by that, I mean school not formally. He was taken by his father out on the road when he was a very young child with a bunch of horse traders and gamblers. And he learned the ropes out on the Texas frontier with these roving gamblers. He learned how to handle an operation. He learned how to find gamblers with money, and he learned how to win their money.
Early on, you write about Benny Binion and his dreams of creating an empire of vice. I was wondering if you could share with us the passage where you write about that dream and nobody else being able to keep up with a very wild and bloody journey.
He had started his criminal career in Texas, and soon no one there could top his power and sway. Binion ruled his Lone Star Kingdom for a decade as dollars flowed and blood ran. From his Dallas perch, he embodied the American dream, if one dreamed of an empire of vice. Then he moved to Las Vegas, as the modern version of that city was being born. There he helped lead a wave of dirty money and dangerous men who transformed it from a desert watering hole to the century's great gambling capital. Binion employed timing, temperament, and access to loads of cash to be one of Las Vegas's vital new pioneers, a cowboy counterpart to the syndicates from the coast. He brought high-stakes dice games. He created the World Series of Poker, too. As much as anyone, Binion made Vegas a mecca for high rollers. Before he was done, they were putting up a statue of him, and thousands were chanting his name. The nation's history is packed with legendary outlaws, but none of them can match Binion's wild, bloody, and holy American journey. He rubbed shoulders with some of this era's biggest celebrities and its richest men. He did business with, and counted as friends, the most notorious of mobsters. He was chased and nearly destroyed by the most powerful figures of his time, from J. Edgar Hoover to the President of the United States. It is still said in Las Vegas that you can't understand the town without understanding Binion, that he put the gamble in Vegas, that he ignited a worldwide revolution in poker. All of it is true, but his story looms larger and wider than that. There is simply no one who went from murderous street thug to domineering crime boss to revered businessman to civic treasure like Benny Binion. No one comes close.
That is Doug Swanson reading from his biography of Benny Binion called Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion. Did anything that Benny Binion did in Dallas in his early years portend the enormous things that he brought about once he came to Las Vegas?
Well, I think in a way, certainly. I mean, he was the king of Dallas gambling, the king of North Texas gambling for a long time, and he did that with a combination of forces. He dominated his enemies, and he did that either by controlling them or killing them, and he owned the police force, and he owned the courts. So he had it all covered, and he learned how to run an operation, and he learned how to make powerful friends. I think he transferred a lot of that to Las Vegas when he was ultimately run out of Dallas in 1946.
Now, you work in Dallas, where some of Binion's earliest exploits took place. Did Benny Binion leave his fingerprints on Dallas in any way, the way you did here?
Oh, sure. I gave a reading the other day, and a signing and a speech at a local church, and about 250 people showed up, and I would say half of them had some relationship to Benny Binion. and it was a good relationship. They loved him. People everywhere loved him, or else they were deathly afraid of him. He knew how to make friends. He knew how to bring loyalty to the equation, and people still talk about him with great affection.
In assembling this story, and I imagine you talked to a lot of people who still spoke of him with great affection, did you have any trouble separating tall tales from fact, or trouble accepting that certain facts were true when they seemed really, really outlandish?
Oh, sure. I mean, the Binions had built up many great myths and stories about Benny, some of which were true, some of which weren't. There's one that goes back to the early days of Dallas where as the family tells it, Benny was driving along in Dallas and had a car wreck. He got out of his car and was immediately confronted by 14 men. And he didn't know what to do, but he ripped the bumper from his car and one by one fought off the attackers. And when it was all done, according to this story, there were 14 men lying on the ground, bloody, and Benny stood there with the bumper like some kind of character out of Gladiator or something. And the truth is, once you go back and do some research, the truth is, he hit one person with the bumper, and it was a middle-aged woman, and Benny was most likely drunk that night.
So a little less than Paul Bunyan-sized mythology there.
Sure. I mean, they just, mythology is the right word. There was so much of that built up around Benny Binion that was one of the big challenges of the research here was trying to cut my way through that. And I mentioned this thing I did the other night where 250 people were there. Many of them started asking me questions about, well, did you hear Benny did this? Did you hear Benny fought the Klan? Did you hear Benny killed 20 people at one time? And I said, yeah, I heard all those, but I only printed the stuff I believed had some veracity to it. If I couldn't confirm it, I didn't put it in the book.
So this is beginning to sound like Liberty Valance. You know, the fact becomes legend, print the legend.
but you didn't do that. Well, I wanted a book that was properly sourced. I mean, there are still people out there who say that they disagree with what I wrote, but I didn't put in anything in this book. I didn't put anything in it that I couldn't back up with a document or an interview or some sort of, if not proof, at least a reasonable argument that it was true.
So you got Benny Binion, you know, the legend taking out all these people with a torn off car bumper and all these other stories, things like that. Why did he leave Dallas for Las Vegas come the late 40s?
He said, as he put it, my sheriff sat on his ass and got beat. Excuse the language. He had a sheriff that he trusted, that worked with him, that winked, that let Benny run his operation. But that sheriff ran a terrible campaign. And at the same time, the local district attorney was replaced by another DA. And the new DA was a reform candidate. And so Benny realized his time in Dallas had run out. So he loaded up his Cadillac with allegedly $1 million in the trunk, got two of his henchmen, armed them with Tommy guns. And in December 1946, he took off for Las Vegas.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Doug Swanson, author of the book Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. Binion, as you have heard, had a reputation as being something of a family man, even a warm-hearted boss, and also happened to be a cold-blooded mob boss. You wrote that Benny Binion was a curious contradiction of idiocy and genius. Amazing split there. How does a man who was illiterate for his entire life build a gambling empire, first in Dallas and then in Las Vegas?
Well, he was brilliant. I think he was a genius. Now, he was completely uneducated. He only went to second grade, and that was at a bad school. He couldn't do multiplication. When he was sent to prison for tax evasion, they gave him an IQ test, and he came back with an 89, which is nobody's idea of a genius. But he could read people tremendously. He could calculate odds, obviously. He knew what people liked. He as he always said, treat the little people like big people. He knew how to sell the product, and he knew how to promote himself. That was what he did really well.
Well, in terms of that promotion and that all of the things that he did in that field, could you say that he was one of the pioneers, maybe the pioneer of hospitality, the whole concept of hospitality in Las Vegas?
Oh, I think so. I mean, he was not notorious. He was famous for sending limos out to the airport to pick up anyone, whether you were rich or not. He comped meals. He was very generous. He would walk through the casino just giving away chips, giving away money. And part of that, perhaps, was philanthropic, but part of that was shrewd business. He, again, worked on the loyalty of his customers, and people would come back again and again to the Horseshoe because they felt they knew Benny. They could walk into the Horseshoe restaurant where Benny kept his amounted to his office there at his favorite table and sit down and talk to him. And people loved that about him.
He was able to adapt to changes whenever they came at him, and perhaps that's best illustrated by his role in creating what became known as the World Series of Poker. What was Benny Binion's role in creating that competition?
Well, he was the one who did it, he and his son Jack. He had gone to a competition in Reno in 1969 at a casino there, saw some poker players playing, a handful of them. And on the way back to Vegas, he and Jack were talking, as the story goes, and decided, well, why don't we bring it to the Horseshoe and we'll call it the World Series of Poker. They brought in just a handful of players. Benny never thought it was going to be a big deal. He just thought he might use it to draw in a few extra gamblers onto the casino floor who would watch the poker players and then go lose their own money at the tables.
In the process of gathering info for the book and then writing the book, were there moments where you felt some real sympathy for Benny Binion? I mean, there are a lot of places where he seems like a very difficult guy to care much about.
Oh, sure. I was telling somebody the other day, I was surprised by how much I liked him at the end of it. And that's not to look away from the things he did that were unsavory or even beyond that were really horrible and violent. But I came to admire the man. He came back again and again. He had a vision. He exercised that vision. He overcame any number of obstacles, including a stretch in federal prison, as we mentioned earlier. You know, again, people loved him. If you came in contact with him and you weren't on his bad side, you were a friend of Benny's, you were a real friend.
Hmm. You write in the acknowledgments that two of Binion's three surviving children wouldn't speak to you for the book. Do you think it was that they just weren't interested in revisiting a troubling past, or were they protective of their father?
I think it's probably both. I had a couple of amicable conversations with Jack Binion. The son, he just wasn't interested in talking to me. The other daughter, Becky, I've heard, was working on her own book. I don't know if that's true, but perhaps that's a part of it. The one daughter I talked to, Brenda, who's a rancher in Amarillo, Texas, was really wonderful, and she knows what her father did. She knows there were things in his background that maybe aren't mentioned in polite company, but what she wanted was the full picture of her father. He was a great dad to her and a great horseman and a great businessman, and she wanted that depicted. So she, I think, tolerated some questions about his more difficult side so she could talk about what a great family man he was.
So what did you think you revealed in this book that might have been upsetting to his children?
I've heard, after the book was published, I heard that what has really upset them was the disclosure that, in his later years, Benny became an informant for the FBI. Mm-hmm. That, to my knowledge, has never been published before, and it was there in the FBI records. And to me, it was a pretty stunning development. I mean, here's a guy who's been chased most of his adult life and sent to prison by the FBI, and then he turns around and becomes a stool pigeon for them.
We're talking with Doug Swanson, an investigative reporter with the Dallas Morning News. He is the author of Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. There's more conversation just ahead. This is KNPR's State of Nevada. Bye. Welcome back to KNPR State of Nevada. I'm Dave Becker, and we're talking with Doug Swanson, author of the book Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Texas poker. Benny Binion is portrayed in this as a pawn in the federal crackdown on organized crime in Las Vegas. He ended up being convicted of one felony, just one felony. What was he eventually convicted of?
Tax evasion. And he was pursued, this was another surprise, by the highest level of federal government. And by highest, I mean up to the White House. That some of the memos I turned up showed meetings taking place in the Attorney General's office, the Attorney General of the United States, where FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover would be there. And there would be references to suggestions from President Harry Truman on how to pursue Benny Binion.
He joined the Great Migration of American Organized Crime in the 1940s out to Las Vegas. And I'm wondering if you could share with us a portion from the start of Chapter 9 in your book called Mobbed Up Pilgrims.
Sure. He probably did not think about it in such terms, but Binion now embraced an American archetype. He had fled his past, headed west, and sought a fresh start in the wide open spaces of the Promised Land. Doing so, Binion replicated the intrepid American homesteaders in covered wagons who had made the trek before him, though they had neither henchmen with Tommy guns nor a cool million in the trunk. At least he wore a cowboy hat. Less majestically, Binion had joined one of the great migrations in American organized crime history, the mob diaspora of the 1940s. They came from New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, Miami, and anywhere else they felt pressure from the competition or heat from the cops. And they were streaming to Nevada in their long black limos, with blonde mistresses beside them and the high dollar reek of Zizani cologne. It was manifest destiny, felony division. The great historian Frederick Jackson Turner had declared the Western frontier, which he called the meeting point between savagery and civilization, and the very expression of American individualism, closed in 1893. But Las Vegas wasn't closed even by 1946. It was, in fact, opening up. This would come to represent a different sort of frontier, savagery and civilization meeting in an entirely new manner, and individualism expressed in ways not seen before. Within a mere 15 years, U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy would call Las Vegas the bank of America's organized crime, as mobsters, their careers born anew in the Nevada desert, skimmed millions from their casino operations. And in only a few decades, the Union Plaza Hotel in downtown Las Vegas would feature a show called Nudes on Ice, while at the Circus Circus you might watch a dwarf boxing a kangaroo. This magical transformation would commence as soon as the settlers staked their claims, settlers like Benny Binion.
Manifest destiny felony division. That's pretty well put in just four words, isn't it?
Well, thank you.
So what was Benny Binion's relationship like with some of that first generation of the mobsters who came west, the folks like Meyer Lansky, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohen, and some of the others of that time?
Yeah, it was generally pretty good. I called him in the book the Will Rogers of mobsters because he had nothing but nice things to say about these people. He talks about how Bugsy Siegel was the greatest guy he'd ever want to meet, and there was a gentleman named Ice Pick Willie Alderman, who got that name because of the way he wielded the ice pick, and Binion thought he was just the greatest guy ever. You know, Mo Dalitz and Benny were very close friends. He got along with them really well. I think they were often pretty wary of each other, but they established a working relationship where he didn't mess with them and they didn't mess with him, and they all managed to do business alongside each other.
Yeah, and it sounds like from what you were saying about his becoming a sometime informant for the FBI, the wariness was to some degree justified. When did he start supplying information to the FBI?
That was in the 1960s. He'd gotten out of Leavenworth. He had regained control of the Horseshoe from some of the mobsters who'd taken it over while he was in Leavenworth, Eddie Levinson, one of them. And he established a good relationship with the local FBI special agent in charge, Leo Kuykendall, and I hope I'm saying his name correctly. And Benny worked the guy. Benny worked everybody. Benny worked all the angles, and so he worked the FBI as well. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover hoped that Binion would supply them with some information about skimming going on at other casinos. I never saw any evidence of that. I'm not sure what the quality of the information was that he passed along. It didn't look like it was all that valuable. But for Binion's perspective, the value was that he had the local FBI guy in his pocket, who, by the way, he later hired as a security operative at the Horseshoe.
This is almost reminiscent of a Nevada equivalent of Whitey Bulger in some respects. I mean,
I think so.
Yeah, making friends with an FBI agent. And you suggest that communication with the FBI might have been a business strategy.
Oh, I think so. And going back to this Dallas days, you asked me what he brought with him. That's the way he worked in Dallas, too. He had the most powerful man in the sheriff's department, the guy who was second in command, was one of his best friends in Dallas. And that's the way they worked it here. So he worked it that way in Vegas, too.
Did any of his information help the federal government make a case against other Las Vegas gangsters?
I never saw any evidence of that. That's why I say I don't think he gave them anything that was all that actionable. If indeed he did, it was not revealed in the documents that I was able to find.
Yeah. How long did he act as an informant? You said he started in the early to mid-60s.
Yeah, it was pretty briefly. I would say a year or two, maybe, because that relationship faded. They got new people in. Joseph Yablonsky, who may mean something to you, the name, came in as the FBI agent in charge in Vegas, and he decided he was going after Harry Claiborne and after Benny Binion. So that relationship turned sour in a hurry.
Well, much later, 1989, federal authorities in Las Vegas launched a secret effort to infiltrate the Horseshoe Casino. They even called the effort Operation Benny Binion. What were they trying to prove?
They were trying to prove that there was money laundering going on at the Horseshoe, and that also there was a narcotics operation being run out of there by Ted Binion, Benny's son. So they tried to set up a sting. They wanted to get some of their own people in there with recording devices and get the Binions involved in laundering some sting money. And then they hoped they could shut down the Horseshoe, and that would be a big statement to the other casino operators in town that the feds were on the job and weren't tolerating any of this bad behavior.
Did they have any success?
No. Benny died on them in 1989, so they couldn't go after him. They eventually did indict some people, but all those charges were later dropped, so the investigation turned up a big zero, ultimately.
As you note, Benny Binion died at the very end of 1989, on Christmas Day that year. What lasting impact did he have on Las Vegas? From his time do you still see in the city 25 years later today?
Well, I think he made it, as silly as this may sound, the place to gamble. I was talking, after I wrote the book, to Larry Gatlin, the country singer, on another venture I was doing. And we started talking about Benny Binion, and he said he was sitting in Binion's restaurant one day talking to Benny, and one of the dealers came up and said, hey, boss, a guy wants to bet $100,000 on a roll of the dice. Should we let him? And Binion looked at him and said, hell, it's a gambling joint, ain't it? And that, to me, was what personified what he did. It was a gambling joint. There were no bands. There were no chorus girls. There were no ventriloquists or comedians. He just went there to gamble, and you could gamble all the money you wanted. You could gamble the biggest hand you wanted, and that, besides bringing the gamblers in, it lent a mystique that traveled outside Vegas and brought people in, I think. And a corollary to that is if you came from Texas or anywhere else and you wanted to walk in and shake hands with Benny Binion, well, you could do that, and I don't think that was matched at other places, but you could walk in and talk to this guy who was a big name and a big-time gangster, and he would treat you just like home folks.
If Benny Binion were to walk through downtown Las Vegas and then maybe down Las Vegas Boulevard through the Strip and you see these massive casinos, none of which have any gray areas, they're all operating above board, they're all pretty clean, do you think he'd like what he sees?
I think he would think it's quite wonderful. He loved Las Vegas, at least at the beginning. He described it as the most wonderful place he'd ever seen, and he liked the idea of action and of a convergence of this activity. I think he might be a little astonished at what he's seen, and I don't think if he still had the Horseshoe, I don't think it would change one bit. I think it would still be the old school Horseshoe that it always was, and they would do what they always did, which is take all the money and take it back in the county room and put it in a big pile. And when that pile got too big, they'd start another pile. And that's the way they ran things. And I'm sure he'd still be running it that way if he was alive today.
Benny Binion, as I described him a couple times in our conversation, was known as a cold-blooded mob boss. Yet he was never convicted of murder. The one felony was tax evasion, sort of the, as like Al Capone, I guess. How did he take care of his enemies? I mean, how did that all happen in such a way that it never ended up on his hands directly?
Well, he did admit to killing two people. One was a rival bootlegger, and the other was a rival gambling operator. He shot both of them and walked away from both of those actions because he owned the local authorities. They let him walk. Now, the others, he's accused of ordering the deaths of, he had people who worked for him. There was a famous local Dallas hitman named Lois Green, who was alleged to have killed many people under Binion's orders. And that's the way he operated. He had people who did the work for him, and they generally did it pretty well, although there was a guy in Dallas who was a rival gambler named Herbert Noble, and it took them 12 attempts to finally dispatch him.
So he had people.
Yeah, he had staff.
Yeah, he had staff. They did that sort of thing. All right.
Allegedly. He never admitted to it.
Yeah, he never admitted to it.
But his fingerprints were all over a bunch of these things.
But no convictions.
That is correct.
Doug Swanson is investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He is the author of Blood Aces, The Wild Ride of Benny Binion, the Texas gangster who created Vegas poker. Doug Swanson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave. It was a pleasure.